You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator. This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
It's on!
Hi, everyone, from New York Magazine and the Vox Media Podcast Network. This is On with Kara Swisher, and I'm Kara Swisher. Today, my guest is playwright, screenwriter, novelist, and musician Susan Laurie Parks, or SLP, as she's sometimes called. Parks is one of those rare multi-hyphenate talents. In 2002, she became the first African-American woman to win a Pulitzer Prize in drama for her play Top Dog, Underdog. The 2022 revival of that play won her a Tony. She was the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant and a Guggenheim Fellow. She's written a slew of plays, including one about the pandemic, Plays from the Plague Years, in which she also starred in 2023. She's the author of a novel titled Getting Mother's Body. She's a screenwriter for the biopic The United States versus Billie Holiday, among others, and has written for television. And she also plays and sings in a band, Sula and the Joyful Noise. I saw her latest play, Sally and Tom, at the Public Theater in New York recently. It's about a theater troupe that's writing and performing a play about the former U.S. President Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, the woman that some people refer to as his mistress. But that's not an appropriate description. She was, in fact, the mother of at least six of his children, and as one of the hundreds of enslaved people on his plantation, also his legal property. The play is Quintessential Parks, a complicated and personal take on U.S. history and race relations, as well as about love and reparations. It's coming at a time of pushback against teaching the real racial history of the United States, with Republicans proposing more than 100 bills in more than 30 states to restrict or kill diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in schools, industry, and the government. So I want to talk to her about all of that and how she's thinking about history in her latest works. Our question this week comes from Aminatou Sow, a writer and co-founder of Tech Lady Mafia. She was also the co-host of the podcast Call Your Girlfriend, and she's a friend of mine. We'll be back with all that after a quick break. Support for this show comes from Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration for teams to accomplish what could otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually, we're great, but together, we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of two, 200, or 2 million, or whether your team is around the corner or on another continent altogether, Atlassian software is built to keep you all on the same page from start to finish. That way, every one of your teams, from engineering and IT to marketing, HR, and legal, can stay connected and moving together as one towards shared company-wide goals. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Support for this show comes from Virgin Atlantic. Travel can be stressful. I don't think that's a controversial take. Sure, we all love taking a vacation, and that moment we finally get a chance to relax,
but we're always so focused on the destination that the journey just feels like a means to an end. Well, what if it wasn't? What if the time you spent getting there was just as enjoyable as the vacation itself? That's what Virgin Atlantic believes. That's why they offer loads of special extra touches that make your trip one to remember for all the best reasons. Picture this, you made it to the airport, checked in your bags, and finally have a moment to settle in before takeoff. If you're flying upper class, you could be putting your feet up in a Virgin Atlantic clubhouse at London Heathrow with food made fresh to order and champagne delivered straight to your table with a tap of a QR code. I mean, it's rude not to, right? Once you're in the air, the experience continues with deliciously different dining, seriously comfy seats, and the best crew in the sky by miles. Check out virginatlantic.com for your next trip and see the world differently.
Support for this podcast and the following message is brought to you by E-Trade from Morgan Stanley. Take control of your financial future with E-Trade. No matter what kind of investor you are, our tools and resources can help you be ready for what's next. Now, when you open an account, you can get up to $1,000 with a qualifying deposit. Terms apply. Learn more at etrade.com/Vox. Investing involves risks. Morgan Stanley Smith Barney LLC, member SIPC. E-Trade is a business of Morgan Stanley.
Susan Laurie Parks, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kara. This is fun.
I know. I'm excited to talk. You have so many titles. You're a playwright, a novelist, a screenwriter, a showrunner, a songwriter, an actor, an instructor, a musician. Besides exhausting me, which one of those feels most comfortable? And are there any that don't fit quite right from your perspective?
No, I'm a human being.
Mm-hmm.
So they all feel good. I mean, I don't allow a title if it doesn't feel right. And I am doing the work in all those fields. So,
right.
Yeah.
But let's talk first about your latest play, Sally and Tom. It first premiered in Minneapolis at the Guthrie Theater, but now it's showing at the Public Theater in New York. I loved it. I thought it was beautiful. It was a beautiful play, but also very funny. There are two storylines here. It's about a female playwright, Luce, her romantic partner, Mike, and their very progressive theater troupe called, ironically, Good Company. They're preparing to put on a play. I don't think it's ironic that you did it on purpose. They're preparing to put on a play. She's still in the process of writing. In fact, they're all in the process of rewriting it. The play is about Sally Hemings, an enslaved woman with whom President Thomas Jefferson had a decades-long relationship and several children. She was 14 when it started, and he owned her. She was also the half-aunt to his children and the half-sister to his wife, who had died early. For those who don't know, can you tell us more about the background and controversy of the real Sally and Tom story? This is not a love story, as you'd say.
Yeah.
Why would you want to take it on, and why now?
Why now? I started taking it on 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a long time in the making, where some of my works, like Top Dog Underdog, I wrote in 3 days. Sally and Tom, it was a longer train to an equally lovely destination. But at the time, I was writing a play called Father Comes Home from the Wars, which is about enslaved people. And it's kind of, I love myths. So I was sort of centering enslaved people in a mythic context, combining lots of myths like the Bhagavad Gita, like the Odyssey, like the Iliad, all kinds of these great African myths and all that, to sort of create this narrative in which enslaved people during 1864 were at the center of this. And so I was sitting there, and as I do when I have a moment, you know, something else will enter into my mind. So we were, you know, in tech, you know, you're in theater, and we were in the Ansbacher in the Public Theater, you know, sitting there in tech and all that. And I'm sitting there going, okay, you know, this is cool, this is cool, this is cool. Oh, I'm the one who did Lincoln and Booth. So I thought, Sally and Tom, Lincoln and Booth, Sally and Tom, wouldn't that be fun?
Mm-hmm. But why? It's obviously this story has been around a lot, but why this story?
Right. I love patterns. So I just realized a pattern. So when something speaks to me, I don't ask why necessarily. So Lincoln and Booth came to me one day. I said, okay. Sally and Tom. Okay. So I don't know. So the why in the moment, I don't know. But when, you know, if I'm a fish swimming in the ocean and the lure, you know, the bait, you know, comes from the cosmos and it goes, oh, and it catches you and you go, yeah. That's my story I want to tell. So that's, you know, so that's good enough for me.
The play's about writing a play called The Pursuit of Happiness,
yes,
which had been previously named E Pluribus Unum, Out of Many One.
Mm-hmm.
Explain the structure. Why do you set it up that way instead of just focusing on the historical narrative about Sally and Tom? And in fact, what they're doing is historiography as actors in the midst of telling a story and how to tell it in the end, changing the past. So they're trying to do a historiography in a lot of ways.
Or they're trying to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
Because historiography, I mean, history is, you know, that phrase, history is what's written by the winners, or what do you say?
Mm-hmm.
History is written by the ones who could write it down, whether they were winners or not, you know? So
right.
My people are the people who weren't allowed to read or write. So,
right.
And oral history is only so good, you know? So saying that we're trying to change history implies that we believe everything that was written down.
Yes, that's a fair point. It's that they're trying to figure out what history was.
Yeah, they're trying to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Like a writer would hear it. They're trying to hear it. And it's not just 2024 people are trying to hear 1790s people. We're trying to hear each other. It's, we are history in 2020. It's us, too. It's us and everything we do and don't do and all that.
I was going to say the main character, Luz, is a playwright and an actor. She's mm-hmm. Black. She's in a romantic relationship with a white guy who she feels dependent on to raise money for the play's production. She's also playing Sally Hemings, while he plays the man who owns her, Thomas Jefferson. Offstage, however, she's the brains of the operation and creative energy of the theater company.
Yeah.
The play is a work in progress. She's a work mm-hmm. in progress. And real life mm-hmm. overlaps with her stage character, Sally. Talk about that interplay and talk about us that you just referred to.
Okay. Theater or art making is the way that I find that I can invite myself and others into conversation about beautiful things and about difficult things, about joy and about sad things, all those things. And so the only way to embrace Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson and their relationship was through theater. And what better? And then, well, then let's just make it about people putting on a play, because it's not, to me, in Sally and Tom, the relationship between Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson isn't just about, you know, like race relations or those kinds of things, or consent, or these labels, or these words that we use to frame things in our effort to understand them. To me, Sally and Tom is about how the world is made, how we make the world, how we make it every day, how we all have a hand in it. And so that's kind of why I put playmaking at the center of the story. And what saves the narrative, a group of people of all colors and stripes and persuasions coming together to create the narrative together. And that's what saves the play. That's what allows us to look into the past and say, okay, truth and reconciliation. We can find a way to go forward or find a way to at least talk about some of these difficult things.
Right. So we talk about that because, you know, one of the things about the relationship between Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson is, and you note this, is what's real as opposed to what's speculative. So talk about how you wrestle with the question of what remains unknown as you wrote the play. Obviously, Luce is very preoccupied with this question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so much is unknown about Sally Hemings. And like I said to you when we hung out a little bit in the theater before the show, there is a wealth of brilliant scholarship that has done some brilliant prize-winning, noteworthy, I don't know what you call it, I don't know the proper term
historians,
for it.
Historians, like Annette Gordon-Reed, but go
exactly,
ahead.
Historians. And for me, because as I understood it, they were pieced together from things, I didn't want someone's piecing together of what might have been be in my fiction. So I was very clear. So I stayed away from Annette's brilliant book and others and focused on the art of theater and what that's about and how that can create a world.
Mm-hmm.
What I did is I went to Monticello a lot and I stood around on the grounds and I stood in the rooms and I lay on the floor. The guides had a nice time with me. And I asked them questions before Sally Hemings' room was discovered, which was a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I was gently asking a guide, a tour guide, I know her room is here somewhere. Mm-hmm. I know it's here. I can feel it. She was here, right? In her, and he said, no, ma'am. And of course, he was honest. That's as much as he knew. But I could feel, you can feel things. I would stand in Patsy's room and the scene where the women are lying on the floor, that came from that because her room is—
was just above his.
Just above her father's.
Which is downstairs. Yeah, I've
exactly.
been there many times. So, and also, a lot has changed in the storytelling there. That, you know, it used to be Mr. Jefferson and very, you know, laudatory. And now, they're, and it's been controversial too, but it's been, it's very much focused on the enslaved people, much more so, including the people who are doing the tours, which has changed rather drastically, I would say, which is interesting.
Yeah, we don't have to be... we don't have to pretend things didn't happen. We just have to continually find a way to have nuanced conversations about difficult things.
Oh, good luck. And, well, again, we'll get to that. I know, you're doing that here. You're absolutely doing
here
it.
Here I am.
In Jesse Green's review of the play in the Times, he wrote, lumpiness and bagginess are often part of Park's aesthetic. In her plays, life and history are never smooth. We cannot see everything underneath the present. In particular, her Jefferson demonstrates it's nearly impossible to recognize the evil we do in choosing to buy the evil we live in. Still, she argues you cannot merely blame the times. Do you agree with that?
That you can't
blame the times that he lived in?
If he says I'm a man of his, of a man of my times, when he says that,
yeah,
because there were other his contemporaries who were of equal social status, who did things differently, and he notes that himself. You know, Ben Franklin freed his enslaved people, as did George Washington, who freed his enslaved people, and there were John Adams did not own enslaved people, so there were different ways to do it. And I think that's a call to all of us, that we just can't sink into this morass of like, you know, this is the times I'm living in. We're making the times. We are the times. And just that excitement, I think, that excitement that I get knowing that I have a hand in the way the world is made.
So the play directly calls out the founder who wrote All Men Are Created Equal as a racist and sexual predator, really. You're also talking about trying to understand a relationship that has a pretty deeply fucked up power dynamic, which is a hard thing to depict, right, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and since we never use those words in the play,
you don't.
One is left to draw their own conclusions from it.
So, go ahead. Sorry.
No. I just wanted. That's very important. That, I mean, me. You know, you. We're writers here. You and me. We labor. I do anyway. We labor over every single word.
Right.
So those words are not used in the play.
No.
Although
you do. You don't use also consent. You don't use a lot of words. Although it's certainly implied, and certainly implied that she doesn't have a choice, and she says that.
She does say that. She calls him a liar and a coward. Mm-hmm. She tells him she hates him. She tells us that sometimes she doesn't want to even talk to him ever again. She says it wasn't rape as such, or maybe that's all it was.
Right.
He says, I loved her. He says, imagine I was on a ship. The ship was in the middle of the ocean, and I felt like I was in a sea of tears.
Right.
You know, so they're saying things that, you know, need to be said so we can get to know them.
Right, exactly, which makes it more difficult. So we're at a different time now, even than we were 4 years ago. Republicans are fear-mongering with the idea that white kids are being taught that being white is bad. Ron DeSantis in Florida is being awful with this Stop Woke Act and claiming that black people benefited from slavery. Mm-hmm. As you're researching Sally and Tom, how much was America's current rewriting of history in the forefront of your mind? But if you started a decade ago, perhaps you saw it coming.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've been trying to rewrite. I mean, that's the American dream. Just like pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah.
You know.
The memory hole is deep.
Yeah. Yes. And it's unfortunate because it does not allow us as beautiful human beings to wrestle with the stuff that I feel could truly make this country truly great. I think that's where we get our greatness from, when we look at difficult things and we find ways to talk about things, even if we're not always agreeing, you know? That's what I feel. I mean, you know, our dads were in the military. You know, I grew up, and again, my dad wasn't a, you know, gung-ho, like, patriot dude. He joined the military because that was the only way that he could get afford to go to college. And my mom's family was a little better off, but not much. And this is the way that they could afford to just live. But at the same time, we had a respect for this country and what it could offer. And, you know, Sally and Tom is very much a love letter to America. And it's a love letter to theater. But it's not one of those love letters like, hi, I love you. Let's make a heart. Oh, it's all good. You know, that kind of bullshit. It's like, hey, I love you. So let's have a conversation. All right? Let's wrestle. Let's wrestle it out, you know?
Well, in that regard, in another recent play of yours, plays for the plague year called A Play for James Baldwin, who was this mentor of yours, I'm going to play a clip that comes just after his character has finished telling you that American history is revisionist in nature and that it feeds on the lack of memory. He says there are people of all ages in America right now who have dementia. The country is stuffed to the gills with some crazy people. I'm not only talking about people who consider themselves white. These are interesting times. And you say,
any tips, Mr. Baldwin?
Don't fear pain. Don't fear joy. Say what you think, even if it's unpopular, even among those who you consider to be your people. Shout if you have to, but don't shout so much that you lose your voice. That can happen, even to you, even to me. Praise and encourage the young folks. Look into the eyes of the elderly. Don't forget about the elderly. They want you to forget about the elderly. They want you to forget those who have been there. Revisionist history. They want to pretend things didn't happen. It's a time to work. Work history. Work memory, which is the flabbiest of all American muscles. America's so muscular, popping out of its own clothing, so proud of the way it looks when it walks down the street. As it should be, I guess. Pride on such levels is in direct proportion to the shame.
Oh, that's a line. Also, American flabbiness of memory. Your mentor speaks to you from the great VAU. So talk about the flabby muscle.
Yeah, that was a funny thing because that's my mentor's, me putting words in James Baldwin's mouth.
That's right. That's right. But it sounds like him. Sounds like something he'd say. I just was listening to him talking to Toni Morrison. It had some of that in it. It was that topic, actually.
And that's the actor in that clip is Leland Fowler, who plays Devin and Nathan in Sally and Tom right now. We're just continuing the wonderful working relationship. But the flabbiest of all American muscles, like I said, I do think we in America need to just work those muscles.
But we don't want to work that muscle. That's a muscle we would rather atrophy. From what I can tell.
Yes. And we don't want to eat our vegetables. And, we, you know, all the things that we don't want to do because they benefit structures that do not benefit our long-term health. And you have kids, you know. I have a kid. You know, we talk this talk all day, how to choose your foods and your friends and, you know, your apps and whatnot, so that you will create a life worth living, where you create a sustainable environment for yourself and for those around you and for the world. And we need to be encouraged to embrace those conversations and that to respect, actually to look again, to respect the past and to look again. The conversations I've heard coming out of people who have seen Sally and Tom, one person described himself as a country club Republican. He said, well, I'm a country, you know, he's a white man, you know, I'm a country club Republican. Well, I'm just saying, you know, because we don't want to assume, you know, I'm a country, because, you know, Clarence Thomas, hello. I'm a country club Republican. And we didn't just start having this wonderful conversation about the play. And he had come to see the play because he wanted to have a conversation. So he's working his muscle, and the flabbiest of all muscles. It is... James Baldwin does not say where that muscle is located. It is, of course, the heart.
100%. We'll be back in a minute.
Support for this show comes from the Harvard Business Review. I made a career out of taking to task some of the tech industry's biggest players. And honestly, some of these guys, and they're all guys, really had no clue what they were doing, and they could probably have benefited from some of the resources available at Harvard Business Review. Harvard Business Review is a top source for smart management thinkers. Cultivated by some of the greatest minds in business, the Harvard Business Review is a trove of rigorous insight and best practices. It's more than just a flagship magazine, too. You can find the same level of expertise on hbr.org, and for just $10 a month, a subscription unlocks unlimited access to a variety of resources like hundreds of articles, podcasts, newsletters, case studies, and so much more. I use HBR all the time to look up all kinds of cases, and not just in tech, and also listen to their podcasts. I look at their newsletters, and I really, 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 most of all, like the articles, which have a different perspective that I might have to give me ideas. While much of Harvard Business Review's content is available for free after signing up at their site, subscriptions to unlimited content start at only $10 a month. Go to hbr.org/subscriptions and enter the promo code Kara right now to get 10% off your subscription. Again, to save 10% off your HBR subscription, go to hbr.org/subscriptions and enter the promo code Kara.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
I want to talk about how the play Sally and Tom fits in your larger body of work. We just spoke about plays for the play gear, which was its own kind of play. But in 2002, you became the first Black woman to be awarded a Pulitzer in drama for your play Top Dog Underdog, which also premiered at the Public Theater and starred Jeffrey Wright and Don Cheadle. What a cast. Yeah. I did see this. Top Dog Underdog does a similar thing as Sally and Tom by linking U.S. history and the history of slavery to modern systemic racism and I would say very discreet ways. It's about two brothers named Lincoln and Booth who are living together. And Lincoln, a Black man, has the job playing Abraham Lincoln, who tourists shoot at. Once again, you're using the format of play acting to make your point, correct?
Mm-hmm. No? Because it's all the world's a stage.
Right. Well, Lincoln and Booth are very different from Sally and Tom, Luce and Mike. Luce and Mike are very highbrow. She's writing these complex and long monologues about social justice and change, while Lincoln and Booth speak in vernacular with lots of swearing. The plays are different, but it seems to me there are similarities between the two sets of characters and their trajectories. Maybe you don't agree with me, but I felt there were. But that's just me, because I reread it again.
Thank you. No, but thank you for even, I mean, this is just a cool conversation to have. I appreciate it. I was telling the actors in Sally and Tom, I was saying that Sally and Tom is like Top Dog Underdog for everybody. Hmm. So if you see Top Dog Underdog, you enjoy it, it moves you and, you know, encourages you to wrestle with history, you know. Mm-hmm. Sally and Tom is a place where more kinds of people have an in. And it is the same kind of activity, you know, wrestling with history, finding your place, asking if you belong. Where's the place for me? Also, in all my work, I would say, even the songs I write with my band, all my work, there is a, what I call, do I tell the actors, it's a net, an invisible net. I think the color is green, and it's made of love. And so one can throw themselves into the work, whether as an audience member or as an actor or as a designer, whatever, member of the team, and they will throw themselves fully in and the work will catch them. It's made that way so that you can go to your deepest place and be okay.
And whoever you happen to be. So it's mm-hmm. interesting because every week on the show, we do a segment called Ask an Expert, where we get a question phoned in from an outside expert.
Oh.
This week, writer Aminatou Sow had a question for you.
Hello, I'm Aminatou Sow, and I'm a writer. The big question I would like to ask is if you have noticed a palpable change or an evolution in the predominantly white theater audiences that attend your plays.
Oh,
Good question.
I mean, that's a really cool question. Have I seen a change in evolution in the predominantly white theater audiences that attend my plays? I haven't been taking any exit polls. It's a great question, and because my work varies so much from project to project, I'm just thinking about this. Right, I have not ever thought about this, and I would say that we, all the people, are getting to know each other more thoroughly in our infinite variety. That is something. That is because I would say, so maybe 20 years ago when I was playwriting and I would go and do a talk back or whatever, people would say, there was a common question, often from a person who was not of African descent. They would go, what do Black people think about, like that. So there was an assumption of a monothought, right? And now I do think as they see the beautiful multiplicity, the beautiful variety of what it means to be Black, that there is a greater understanding. Just like Black folks, we look at European American culture and we go, there's lots of different kinds of white folks. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the audiences are going, wow, there are lots of different ways to experience the Black experience. When I was growing up, again, also my dad and mom, it was the Black experience. It was a thing, you know, and now it is a many thing, a many splendid.
We contain multitudes, right?
We can. That's right. Walt Whitman.
I always say that when they years ago when people were talking about what do gay people think. I was like, we contain multitudes. I don't know. We haven't met today.
Exactly.
No idea what that conservative gay man over there thinks in any way.
Right.
And usually it's bad things for me.
but no one would say. But what someone would assume, right? That there's a gay mono. There's just one idea.
Yeah.
And is it, do you think, Kara, do you think it's because they just haven't been exposed to enough folk from the tribe, from the
group?
Or
just not thoughtful, that's all.
You're rough. How are you rough?
I'm sorry.
Oh, come on, peace, love, and understanding.
No, they can do their homework. I never help them. One time when I was gay, they said, I don't know if I understand. I said, well, you should read a book. I'm not helping you. I'm not here to help you on your journey towards liking gay people. Anyway,
I hear you.
The same
right
thing.
Right on, I hear you. Mm-hmm.
But speaking of top dog, underdog, Jeffrey Wright plays the lead. He's fantastic. He's one of my favorite actors. He plays the lead role in Monk in American Fiction. Obviously, he was in Angels in America, astonishing. American Fiction is based on Percival Everett's Erasure. I'm hoping to interview him soon, which came out just before Top Dog, Underdog. I recently interviewed Cord Jefferson, who I've known many years, a few weeks before he won the Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for American Fiction. My favorite movie last year. And we spoke about how when he was a journalist, he felt like he was on the racism beat and still felt like that after he started working in Hollywood. I often feel like that, being gay sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like, what do we think? Do you feel like focusing on race relations, racism, and history is expected of you, or are you just called to it? How do you look at it? Because I do talk about gay issues a lot, too.
Mm-hmm. Right. So do you feel like you're, like, letting gay people down if you don't? You know what I mean?
Sometimes. Yeah.
Sometimes.
I guess they do. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's a line in Sally and Tom when someone goes, is this a Black play? And Scout goes, is this a Black play? This isn't a Black play. And K-Dub says, sure it is. You know? And the actors were like, wow, that's a thorny moment. And I'm like, why is it seen as a negative?
Yeah.
It's a Black play. Yeah. So I could reframe I've been called to speak, to write, to sing the song. And the song comes from somebody like me, this body.
Yeah.
And so I will sing the song. And I don't think I think we each have a contribution to make. And if I'm thinking that, like, having to maybe wrestle with racism is going to hold me back, then it will. If I think that wrestling with racism is just one more way that I can help a lot of people get free, then I'll wrestle with it.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of an argument I had recently about one of the people who used to run Marvel called Black Panther a black movie. And I was like,
oh,
It really isn't. Huh. It's the least of the things it is. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I know. And it was like, and they often go, how did, say, a woman's movie like Barbie do well, or a black movie like Black? I'm like, maybe they're just good movies that everybody likes. And, you know, it was interesting. It was completely racist what this man said, but that's besides the point.
It's very much, but you see it in the awards time when, you know, certain people get nominated or lauded and certain people don't. And you think, oh, okay, I guess it is a woman's movie, or it is a black movie, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of awards, Top Dog Underdog didn't win a Tony until its revival in 2022. Playbill spoke to you about it afterwards. Let's play a clip from that interview.
I feel like theater had a win tonight. Theater had a win. Like, culture took two steps forward, not just one step forward, two steps forward. We didn't just, you know, when we were on Broadway 20 years ago, people said we broke the door down. You know, and a lot of people felt empowered to come behind us. But for us to be recognized tonight is huge. That one foot we had in, culture just stepped with both feet in. And now I feel like it's about inclusion and excellence. Because Top Dog Underdog is a really fucking good play. It ain't just, I'm sorry, I don't want to get into it, but it's very important. Both are important, inclusion and excellence. And that we can, all kinds of people can write at the very highest levels. That's what I aspire to every time I sit down.
Gosh, I really like that idea, because it's something I've been starting to try to explain to people around this argument about DEI. What I say is, what's the opposite of DEI? Diversity, homogeneity, equity, unfairness, and exclusion. I was like, what is, like, there can be excellence and inclusion at the same time. And many people, including high-profile people I cover, are trying to act like it's not. That, you know, everything that happens badly is because of diversity and equity and inclusion and stuff like that. But talk about these two moments, 20 years apart, how you were breaking down doors in 2002, but recognition did not come until 2022. Talk about the idea of inclusion and excellence as both being important.
Right. Well, I do feel like sometimes we're included so that we might be an example to why one should not include us in the future. I do feel like sometimes we are included and not set up for success. I feel like that happens a lot. So that then you can turn around and say, ha, see, she didn't, they didn't, see. But they weren't set up for success. That's a very important aspect. It should be part of it. But I do think it's very important when we invite folks to the table or into the room who have perhaps historically not been invited too often, that it is also important to make it a genuine invitation. Make it a real invitation, not some bullshit thing where 2 days later you can say, "Say, she didn't know." Ha ha ha. You know, I mean, that's just awful. You know, I mean, I don't know about you, but like, I feel like I work five times as hard for half as much. You know, and that has become over the years okay. Okay, I'm okay. I love my work. Love, love, love it. And
I sometimes think my work's better because of that in many ways. It just gives me more edge. You know what I mean? Because it's just so much better than other people's. That's how I feel. I mean, the reporting stuff, not playwriting.
Yes. But yes.
But, you know, DEI has been on such a roller coaster. In 2020, there was a push for more inclusion after the killing of George Floyd and Black Lives Matters protests, which you talked a lot in your plays for the plague year. But now the term DEA hire and diversity hires are being used as yet another attack vector for the right. Bill Ackman, a hedge fund person, has been on a rampage about it, though I'm not sure why he isn't any expert. And I'm feeling like I should write a 90-part tweet on hedge fund investing, but I think I won't because I'm not that arrogant. I mean, honestly, it's also venture capitalists discussing Ukraine. I've had enough of that. But what's your reaction to the backlog? Because they're implying that while trying to make businesses, universities, and our places more diverse, we're giving up those expectations. What's your answer to that when you think about it? It's now said out loud in a way that it wasn't before.
I'm trying to formulate a sentence other than, you know, please.
Yeah.
we are phenomenally able and wonderfully talented. And people who choose to believe otherwise are choosing to believe what my grandmother would call a bald-faced lie to serve their own purposes. Sally and Tom, I mean, well, let's just take Top Dog, Underdog. It's not just good because it's about, you know, race relations or whatever. It's like I said, it's a fucking great play. Mm-hmm. It's beautifully structured. Now, it stands toe-to-toe with any wonderfully, beautifully written play by anybody. Mm-hmm. And I'm pleased about that. And I'm pleased that it's gotten the recognition. Sally and Tom is another beautifully structured play, and it stands with other beautifully written, structured plays. And we, just because someone's brown or black or gay or whatever, doesn't mean they lack certain abilities. They just perhaps have... often have not been afforded the opportunities to succeed. And that is built in to a lot of systems in this country. It just is. It just is. And it's not, that's not coming from hate. It's coming from love. Because when you love an institution or when you love a country, you're going to continue to have a conversation with it and say, come on. It's such a beautiful idea. And people still come here from all over the world because this is such a wonderful place and much more wonderful than where they're living. And that's what Sally and Tom, it's black people are in the show, white people are in the show, an Asian woman is in the show, specifically Korean American.
She's wonderful.
Sunmi Chomet.
Yeah, fantastic. She did a great job.
You know, I think it's the idea of living in abundance or living in scarcity, and those minds are in scarcity in a lot of ways. They want to think it's and have never had a day of scarcity in their lives. At the same time,
it's also living the choice: living in love or living in hate.
Right, right. That's exactly right. Yeah. Let me ask two more questions. One about the play for the Plague Year, which debuted in 2022. While you were doing this too, also your onstage debut as an actor. You play the writer who gets locked up with the hubby and the kid because of COVID. The writer starts writing a play a day to stay sane. The play is separated into days and not acts. Besides being ridiculously prolific, what is it like to switch roles and be the limelight on the stage, not just acting, but also singing? You wrote the songs. You're in a band, Sula and the Noise. Did it change your perspective about writing? After all, Luce is also both the playwright and the lead character.
I know. What's going on?
I know.
The veil is lifting. The veil is lifting. The veil is lifting, and here we are. You know, it just made I mean, I was writing this character of the writer in place for the Plague Year, and then Oscar Eustace, who is the artistic director of the Public Theater, said, "Well, do it, and you be in it." And I was like, yeah. "Oh wow!" And never, it had not occurred to me that I would be in it. I'm such a ham. I love doing public speaking. And I, of course, I love playing music on stage, and I'm such a ham. The actors in our company of Plays for the Plague Year were so generous and kind that they just embraced me, and I learned so much from them and continue to. Yeah.
What did you learn from being on stage?
If I put you in a play, that's my way of saying I love you. I realize that. That's so everyone who made it into a play, I was saying I love you to George Floyd, to Kyleson, to everybody, every single person.
To Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah. I love you. I believe in you. Come on. Come on. Come on now. Like my grandmother would say, come on. Yeah. That's that. You know, I had a grandmother in Chicago, my dad's mom, and then my grandmother in Texas, far west Texas, my mother's mom.
Yeah.
And both of their favorite words were resilience. They had very different upbringings, very different educational, you know, one grandmother's school teacher, the other grandmother a seamstress. Resilience, that was their guiding word.
That's in Sally and Tom, too, resilience.
Yeah. Yeah, she does. She uses the word resilience. Sally Hemings does use that word.
Yeah.
I learned that maybe I wrote Plays for the Plague Year because I could do night after night after night, stand on stage and be myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good enough reason. So my last question. You're also an author. You're a novelist. Good Lord, you're prolific. You're
exhausted. My goodness.
I'm busy and you're very busy. I did a very quick and easy read of your funny novel again, Getting Mother's Body, which is very funny. I'm sorry.
Thank you. It's
about moving around a body. Oddly enough, I actually unearthed my dad and moved him to West Virginia so my grandmother could have him next to her when she died. So I know about moving bodies quite a lot. I know, right? I wrote a whole piece.
I wrote a whole
story in the Washington Post about it. You wrote something that really stuck with me in the last page. Throughout, it's very funny. I recommend it to lots of people. Make you laugh. When I seen her bones, I knew what we all knew. That's we's all going to end up in a grave someday, but there's stops between then and now, which I thought was a perfect way to talk about what life is, stops between then and now. So what is your next stop? A podcast? Are you going to take over my job? What is your next stop?
I'm going to continue to subscribe to your show because I love listening to it because it's so cool to listen to, you know, you wrestle with these
wrestle.
In a loving way.
Not so much love, but okay.
You're tough, man.
It's a version of love.
No, it's good. It's the kind of love that we need. But I'm writing a second novel. I'm building a new show from the band up this time. So I'm hanging out and playing lots of gigs. We play Joe's Pub on the 29th of April, playing gigs with my band, and then going to build my next show from a series of songs that then we'll
on?
So
about?
I'm not going to tell you.
Why not?
Because water boils better when the lid is on it.
Okay. What about the novel? Same thing.
It's also set in Far West Texas in the 70s.
Okay.
And it's over there on my, you know, the board that you put the pins, storyboard. That's what it is.
So how's it cooking?
It's cooking great. I was up at 3 a.m. this morning writing. So life is good.
All right. Well, that's what you do. And you do it so well.
Bless your heart.
Thank you so much, Susan Laurie Parks. What a delight.
Thank you,
what a
Karis
wonderful
Fisher.
Play.
Thank
I
you.
Highly recommend this play. I can't believe it, but it's very funny. It made me so happy after I left.
Oh, I'm so pleased.
Yeah,
thank you.
It's got a lot of hope in it, and it feels like a hopeless time, so I really enjoyed it, and I really appreciate your talent.
Thank you. Thank you so much for hanging out today. Thank you.
On with Kara Swisher is produced by Christian Castro-Russell, Kateri Yoakum, and Megan Burney. Special thanks to Mary Mathis, Kate Gallagher, and Andrea Lopez-Cruzado. Our engineers are Fernando Aruda and Rick Kwan, and our theme music is by Trackademics. If you're already following the show, then just like SLP, I must love you. If not, then I don't. I probably don't. Go wherever you listen to podcasts, search for On with Kara Swisher, and hit follow. Thanks for listening to On with Kara Swisher from New York Magazine, the Vox Media Podcast Network, and us. You can subscribe to the magazine at nymag.com/pod. We'll be back on Monday with more.